Hello, you're listening to America Unchained. My name is Chris Bidwell.
And my name is Richard Dean Winfield.
Today's podcast will center around the right to healthcare for all. The reason we demand it will be in focus. Why the free market solution cannot sustain it and hold the weight. And also a larger history of the right to health, along with what the contemporary relevance to today's crisis is. So, Richard, I want to start off with asking you, why exactly is it that we demand the right to health as a right?
You know, the right to health care has been recognized as a fundamental human right in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in 1948. There is no recognition of the right to health care in the United States Constitution. Yet it is a very basic right for the following reason. The moment we have the minimal status as a bearer of right, that is, as a free person, a person who is not subject to be enslaved by anyone else, but is recognized to have exclusive ownership of their own body, such a person cannot exercise any other right, be it the right to be a member of a family and be a co-determining spouse, to be a member of a civil society and exercise one's economic autonomy, to be a citizen and engage in self-government. To engage in any of these kind of freedoms, one has to be able to have sufficient health to be able to act. And that health is both physical and mental. And without it, one simply cannot exercise one's agency. So if we are at all committed to upholding our freedoms, we have to at the same time be committed to providing that fundamental biological and psychological basis, which is our physical and mental health. And in that regard, the right to what we need to have reasonable physical and mental health is a precondition for exercising any of our freedoms. And I might add that there is a wider kind of health that is also something to which we are all entitled. And that is the right to have a healthy biosphere, a healthy environment, which is such that it allows us to engage in our activities without those activities being disrupted by atmospheric and environmental conditions that make it impossible to live decently. So healthcare is a fundamental right, and we have to confront what is necessary to fulfill it.
So it seems fairly uncontroversial to say that people deserve good healthcare, but then it becomes the question of the means to best employ and get that healthcare. That's what gets debated primarily. In America, we have a very complex system of competitive insurers who connect patients and doctors through a long system of both their financial gain and ultimately sometimes crippling debt of those who try and enjoy healthcare. But the biggest benefits that can be claimed from our system are the abilities for companies to compete with one another and find the most effective technologies and ostensibly create a very strong, healthy, free market economy around healthcare. And that seems to be exactly what's put up against a policy plan like Medicare for All. Not everybody's going to get it because markets are designed to cut certain amount of people out of those markets. So generally, I'd like to ask, what is the nature of this market healthcare system that we're in? How does it relate to this demand that we're trying to make? And can this myth of, or maybe not a myth of competition, be consistently beneficial for those trying to enjoy healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we should recognize that, you know, in any developed civil society in which markets operate as the basis of our economic life, all of the factors that enter into the fulfillment of our right to healthcare take the form of commodities. For example, even research into remedies for both physical and mental pathologies are matters that are undertaken by private enterprises. That also can even include very basic research. I remember when I was growing up, the largest corporation in the world was AT&T, Ma Bell, and it had the famous Bell Labs, which engaged in a tremendous amount of pure research and came up with some of the real groundbreaking advances in much modern technology and collected plenty of Nobel Prizes along the way. You know, they were able, on a for-profit basis, to engage in various kinds of research. And indeed, if we're going to deal with healthcare, we have to have research being done into the nature of our physiology and our mental life and to understand how we can maintain the health of that. Likewise, we need equipment of all sorts to be able to sustain our mental and physical well-being, all sorts of instruments in medical diagnosis and medical care and operations and the like. These have to be provided for. And that likewise, we need medicines of all sorts. These have to be developed. And then, of course, we need to have the medical practitioners, the doctors, the nurses, the clinics, and so forth, all of which are provided in the marketplace. And so one might think that, well, the market can be left to its own designs, and the profit-seeking engine that leads to such continual growth of economic activity is going to provide us with everything we know. But I think if you look at all of the aspects of those things that go into what we need to take care of health, physical and mental, we see that there are problems at every stage. If we just rely upon the market, take research, for example. In order for research to be conducted, it has to be something that is going to enable a company to essentially maintain its profit margins. So this sets some limits on what kind of medical problems are going to be looked into by private companies. They're not, for example, going to devote much of their resources to deal with sicknesses that afflict populations that are too impoverished to be able to provide a viable market for medicines and machinery and so forth that could be developed. Likewise, if there are medical problems that pertain to a very small part of the population, once again, research into remedies for those problems is not going to be something that will be economically viable for a private corporation. This applies equally not only to research into the nature of certain diseases, into vaccines, into drugs. It also will involve research into what kind of therapies and also into what kind of facilities need to be erected for them. The same thing will apply to medical facilities themselves. If you're dealing with locations that don't have a sufficient density of population or alternately a population with enough money to pay for services, then the market can't be counted on to provide sufficient numbers of practitioners and medical facilities to deal with the people who are in need. Now, the other side of it has to do with the question of competition. Because in the abstract, you know, you always come across this ideology that wants to say that the market is subject to a kind of perfect competition where the firms that ultimately are going to prevail are those that are both the leanest and meanest, that are going to be the most efficient in what they produce. And they're the ones who also will provide the best innovations. And these are the ones that will succeed. Well, we all know that that isn't the case. Betamax did not prevail over VHS. And if you think about the general dynamics of competition, firms are always going to be under the pressure to develop all sorts of new products to beat the competition that need not necessarily satisfy a genuine medical need. They're going to be spending a lot of money on advertising. They're going to depend upon gaining investments from shareholders, and thereby they're going to have to pay dividends. They're also likely to have a corporate infrastructure, including CEOs, who will be amassing for themselves the kind of super salaries that we see, particularly in the United States, that are going to be a big drain on their costs. And then, of course, in developing all sorts of new medicines, new therapeutic technologies and the like, corporations are going to require some kind of patent protection in order for it to be viable for them. And that means they're going to have a monopoly power for the duration of these patents and copyrights, which will allow them to keep prices inflated far beyond what might be the costs of development and production. And all these things can contribute to an explosion of costs rather than cost efficiency and the development of the kind of technologies we need.
And that seems to be exactly the main issue. Despite people going by the Affordable Care Act, people still can't afford to get their health care. And it should be totally actualized if we actually take the right seriously. And even despite the newest technologies, I mean, if you can't afford it, then it can't be helpful to anybody. And that's sort of the great irony of the name of the Affordable Care Act. But I guess what you're trying to suggest would be something in contrast to that, which would be, like you say, reorienting the monopoly of healthcare from those kind of patent sharks to a new government-oriented system, one that's even expanding of Affordable Care Act. But could you maybe describe some of the run-ins between those two ideas of monopoly and those two ideas of what business versus the public sector would look like?
I think we first need to turn to the nature of private health insurance, mm-hmm. Because health insurance is a business. It comes into existence as a business. And like any insurance industry, it's a way of spreading, in a way, the social costs so that it allows firms to sell insurance and make a profit, but in so doing, they are enabling people to be able to afford such things as medical care or get through fires that may devastate their homes and be able to survive this by spreading the cost throughout society in that the cost will be distributed among all those who are going to be buying insurance plans. Now, when you have private health insurance, as in any for-profit insurance industry, the premiums that are paid and the coverage that is promoted has to be such as to allow the insurance firms to remain viable. And to remain viable, they have to earn profits so that they can make themselves competitive against those who oppose them in the marketplace. They have to develop new plans. They have to proliferate new, better offerings and the like. And in order to do all of that, they are going to have a business model that tries to offer their clients as little as they can get away with without undermining their appeal to consumers of that insurance. And so what happens? Well, we find in the private insurance business in the United States and elsewhere that private insurers are, for example, not going to be willing to insure people with so-called pre-existing conditions. Because if they do take them on, they're liable to have to pay out high payments to pay for their medical bills. Likewise, they're going to have higher rates for women and older people who will have more medical bills, women because of childbirth and other related things, and older people simply because that's that stage of life when you're physiology is in decline and you're more subject to all sorts of pathologies that need medical intervention. Well, in these ways, the private insurance industry is going to impose certain limitations that are going to put costs on different sectors of the population. They're going to, for example, put a limit on how much lifetime insurance payments you can receive. And that, of course, will be something that can lead to something very common in America, namely bankruptcy. In the United States, the largest cause of bankruptcy is the inability to pay for medical costs. So a typical problem of the private insurance industry is, first of all, it's going to restrict who can be covered. It's generally going to restrict coverage to those who can pay for insurance. And that means there will be people who cannot afford insurance at all, and thereby will not be able to afford any kind of medical care, either physical or mental, that they need. And in addition to this, the private insurance industry is going to, through the dynamic of competition, be offering a huge proliferation of different kind of plans that are going to impose huge administrative costs on caregivers. You know, as we all know, the moment you walk into a doctor's office, you know, you find this mountain of folders and a huge clerical staff that has to deal with all of the insurance filings. Because instead of having a unified insurance system, we have, you know, vast numbers of different kind of insurance plans. And this obviously greatly increases the costs of administering the system. So that's, in a sense, the background of what happens when we rely simply on the marketplace. It's not going to be capable of providing the kind of medical research we need. It's not necessarily going to provide the medical instruments we need. It's not going to provide the medical services and practitioners in sufficient numbers and spread through all regions as we need. And it's not going to provide a medical insurance plan that will be affordable to everyone. And this is not because entrepreneurs are all greedy scoundrels. Some may want to do the right thing, but they cannot remain viable unless they keep their costs in order. And that means they can't do anything that will increase their cost of marketing and production above those of their competitors without risking going out of business. Now, that difficulty is what sets the stage for efforts that began in the late 19th century to try to overcome the limitations of the marketplace as a provider of medical care by instituting public interventions. And as you may know, the first instance of this occurred in 1883 in Germany with the sickness insurance law that Otto von Bismarck, the chancellor of the newly united Germany, instituted. And that basically covered low-wage industrial workers. It provided 13 weeks of sick pay. It covered most of their medical costs. It was funded by employers providing a third of the costs of the plan and employees putting in two-thirds. And this was a way of approaching the problem that was then followed elsewhere. In 1911, the United Kingdom instituted a National Insurance Act to cover wage workers. You had something similar in Russia in 1912, in Japan in 1927. By the 1930s, most countries in Western and Central Europe had similar programs. Meanwhile, the Russian Revolution took place, and in 1920, the Soviet Union instituted a public health care system in its urban areas, although it didn't extend that to the countryside until almost 50 years later. But then the real big expansion of efforts to supplement the market with a public commitment to provide healthcare for all took place first in 1948 in the United Kingdom with the institution of the National Health Service. And this was followed in the 50s by Sweden, Iceland, Norway, Denmark, and Finland. Japan joined the club in 1961. And then Canada in the 60s instituted its own form of public healthcare. And in this way, most nations in the developed world provided every one of their residents with affordable health care. Now, the situation in the United States, as we all know, is something very different. Although FDR put forward the idea of having a public health care system, it never was implemented. Truman spoke about it. Again, it was never quite implemented. And it wasn't until Lyndon Johnson pushed through Congress, Medicare and Medicaid, in 1965, that the United States began to address the problem of fulfilling the right to health care and providing a guarantee. But we know that both Medicare and Medicaid are limited. Medicare is limited and it only applies to people 65 and older. And it doesn't cover all healthcare costs. It has co-pays and deductibles. It doesn't cover long-term care. It didn't cover dental work. Didn't cover all mental health matters. Medicaid, likewise, it had a kind of means test. It only applied to people below a certain income level. And likewise, it had co-pays and deductibles. And that meant that there would be people who are covered by both Medicare and Medicaid who could not afford to use it because they were broke and they didn't have the money for the co-pays and deductibles. And that applied to medicines. They couldn't afford to pay for them, even if the insurance covered part of the cost, but it didn't cover all of the cost. Now, to remedy this situation, Mitt Romney came up in 2006 as governor of Massachusetts with a plan that came to be known as Romney Care, which was following the sort of the model put forward by a conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, which wanted to provide a way of maintaining the for-profit health insurance industry, but to ensure that everyone would be covered and that those who couldn't afford to pay the premiums would be provided with a subsidy. And what Romney instituted in 2006 in Massachusetts was something that Obama succeeded in finally instituting in 2010 under the heading of the Affordable Care Act, Health Care Act. Now, I think we need to face up to both the pros and the cons of the of Obamacare if we want to consider where we are now and what we need to do and what are the remedies.
Right. I want to go back to maybe a little bit of what you were talking about of at the beginning. I mean, as we know, the Affordable Care Act, or more commonly known as Obamacare, is a contemporary example of a reform for the current healthcare system, but obviously rife with issues at the same time. So, I mean, some of those problems could be said states were able to opt in and out of receiving certain subsidies, and those subsidies were required to activate the like full enjoyment of the healthcare plans. And even Obama himself said that there was a problem in general with the underfunding of these subsidies. But nonetheless, a lot of people have still been able to enjoy the affordable health care that the bill has provided, particularly communities in rural areas like in Kentucky or other states that actually took advantage of this. And part of the problems originally in those areas were that there was sparse location for healthcare providers, and a lot of those people still had too low of an income to be able to afford the co-pays or deductibles. So those were some of the structural problems with Obamacare. I guess, in what ways would a single-payer healthcare system or a system that might be proposed that's similar to that, such as the Sanders plan, or how would it rectify those sort of entrenched structural problems that Obamacare tried to rectify but were unable to?
First, I think it's important to look at the limitations of Obamacare then to think of the remedies.
Okay, so then...
Because as I think we need to discuss, the single-payer system is not the only remedy. But Obamacare is a plan that is intended to maintain the for-profit health insurance industry. What it does is it prohibits some of the worst, you could say, abuses of that system. For example, it prohibits refusing clients with pre-existing conditions. It prohibits charging higher insurance rates to women and older patients. It prohibits capping annual, capping lifetime benefits. It requires a basic standard of coverage, which includes mental health coverage and preventive care. And it also provides subsidies to low-income groups. But what it does not do, it does not eliminate co-pays and deductibles. So for that reason, even those people who have the coverage or even have subsidized coverage, they still face difficulties in dealing with copays and deductibles. And moreover, the framework of Obamacare does not succeed in cutting costs of our bloated healthcare industry. The United States spends about 20% of our national income on healthcare. We spend twice as much per person as any developed nation. It's now over $10,000 per person. The results are not better than other nations. In fact, our mortality is definitely lagging behind most other developed nations. And on top of that, we have something within our country that no other developed nation has. That is a huge gap in life expectancy between the rich and the poor. In the United States, if you were in the most affluent group, you are going to live 20 years longer than if you fall within the poor. And that, of course, has a racial dimension, because the poverty rate of African Americans is three times that of whites. That means that this gap in life expectancy between rich and poor is also a racial gap in longevity, as well as in what kind of health one is in. Now, one of the reasons Obamacare was incapable of lowering the bloated costs of our health insurance, of our health, our entire healthcare industry, is it allowed for all of this extra overhead of a proliferation of private healthcare plans and insurance plans, because you had all these advertising costs, all these administrative costs, all these costs of paying dividends to stockholders in private insurance companies, all the bloated super salaries of CEOs who are in collusion with their board of directors. All of these things meant that we were not in a position to really lower the costs that exceed those of other countries by more than 100%. And in addition to that, Obamacare did not cover everyone. It was introduced in 2010. 6 years later, there were still 28 million Americans without health insurance. And as we all know, those of us who have health insurance, and I am one who has health insurance thanks to my employment at the University of Georgia, copays and deductibles are increasing. So it becomes more and more difficult to make use of one's health insurance. And I have plenty of friends who are suffering very severe physical problems, and they can't afford to use their insurance because they can't pay deductibles that can be $5,000 or copays that can run into the hundreds of dollars for every visit. Now, also another side of this is we continue to allow many of our private health insurance packages to be tied to employment. And of course, that presents a lot of insecurity, because if you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. That has led, by the way, to a tremendous decrease in mobility of people and couples in general. With both spouses working these days, it's very hard to relocate and maintain health coverage as you would like. But this also is something that puts American firms at a very very great competitive disadvantage. It sort of killed much of our auto industry, because our fairly strong auto unions managed to negotiate decent healthcare packages from the employers. But our employers like Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler were paying significantly into their healthcare packages when their competitors in Europe and Japan did not have to incur any such costs, because healthcare was provided through national plans that were funded by taxation. So it's neither good for business nor is it good for consumers or employers. Now, we need to speak about the remedies, by the way. And I must say that, I mean, I'm sure all of you probably were a little frustrated watching the presidential debates when the candidates would be discussing the different options. And those options seem to revolve around either maintaining Obamacare and perhaps extending a public option, or alternately having a single-payer system. And there was very, very little talk of why one should be preferred over another. And I think it's important to recognize that there are really three types of options that have been followed by pretty much all the other nations of the world who have succeeded in fulfilling the right to health care. And those three options include a single-payer system, but they include two other types of systems. And we, in a way, in the United States, are familiar with all three of these systems. And I wanted to just discuss the way we are, in which we are.
Well, I know as a member of the gig economy, and I probably speak for others here, and I don't really know the relationship between health and healthcare system and an employer that would actually benefit me. I am signed up for the Affordable Care Act, and this is largely helpful, but I don't know exactly where the stages would be beyond that. I know there's these certain amount of options that you've talked about three, either between the models of France and Germany, where there's a parallelism going on between the private and the public sector, or, you know, a single-payer system, or potentially a national health service. And I feel like I'm walking sometimes into a dark room in these conversations, because it would seem to be an easy issue, but it doesn't actually readily apply to a concrete policy. There's a lot of ways to chop up the same block, so to speak.
Now, first of all, you know, much of the discussion in the U.S., thanks to Bernie Sanders in particular, has focused on a single-payer system, or so-called Medicare for All, mm-hmm. as the best way of moving beyond the limitations of Obamacare and fulfilling the right to health care. But there are only two other countries in the world that have a single-payer system. It's Canada and Taiwan. There are two other options that other nations have followed. One is a national health service, which is what the United Kingdom pioneered under Lord Bevan in 1948. And what a national health service does is it basically nationalizes the health industry, where the government takes over healthcare facilities. It employs healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, and so forth. And essentially, it offers basically free services for healthcare at facilities. And in the United Kingdom, the cost of the National Health Service is actually less than that of any other of the competing systems in the developed world. The average annual expenditure on medical care in the United Kingdom is about two-fifths of what we spend per person. It's $4,192, whereas we're over $10,000. Now, the other option, besides single-payer system, and I need to explain what that means, is the system you have in many other nations, where you have a plurality of different health insurance programs. But they are strictly regulated. They are not for profit. They pretty much offer the same kind of services. Everyone is required to purchase it. And people who can't afford it are provided with a subsidy. So basically, you have 100% coverage. And you have a way of regulating costs. The single-payer system, by contrast, is something that leaves the healthcare providers and drug companies and everything in private hands. What it does is it, in a sense, offers an exclusive government-led or public health insurance plan that covers all necessary health and mental care, does so in a way that eliminates problems of co-pays and deductibles. It covers all costs, and in this way, it also allows the single-payer health system to be in a position to lower costs by having national negotiations with medical equipment producers, drug companies, and healthcare providers to keep their costs in check in a reasonable way. Now, in all three of these options, what will determine whether there are waiting lists and what will be the quality of care is how much public investment goes into them. What is significant is that in all the developed countries in the world, none of these countries are spending more than about half of what we spend per person, and yet they're getting better results in the health outcomes of their population. Now, we are in a way familiar with all three of these options. For example, you can think of the National Health Service as being the equivalent of veterans' hospitals, because veterans' hospitals are owned by the government, all their staff are government employees, and they provide, you could say, specialized care for our veterans. By contrast, we have something like a single-payer healthcare system with Medicare and Medicaid, although obviously, like veterans' hospitals, it does not apply to all of the population. On the other hand, of course, we're familiar with the private health insurance business. But what has been done in most other countries like Japan and Germany is to have a very tightly regulated nonprofit health insurance industry, which covers everyone. Now, all three of these options can work. All three of them allow for healthcare costs to be cut in half with regard to what we spend. We could be saving $1.7 trillion a year if we move to any of these three alternatives to the incomplete coverage and bloated costs of our private system. But I think there is an argument to be made as to why a single-payer system is really the best and most manageable way to go in the United States. And I think it'd be shown in the following way. If we were to take the route of a National Health Service, as the United Kingdom has, that would be equivalent to making veterans' hospitals be the model for all healthcare in the United States. And that would require a vast expenditure, a vast public investment in buying up all of the healthcare facilities and making all of their employees state employees. You don't have to do that with a single-payer health system, because the single-payer health system leaves in place all of the practitioners, all of the drug companies, all of the medical supply firms. They are left as they are. We can negotiate nationally with them to keep costs in check, but essentially, we are simply providing a public health insurance system where we can make use of the infrastructure that is already there with Medicare and Medicaid, expand it, draw people from the private health insurance industry, and get this up and running very quickly with minimal public investment. Now, when I say that as being in a way the most cost-efficient way, we have to keep in mind that if we're going to do this justly, if we're going to make a transition to a Medicare for all system that covers all necessary health care, that means all physical health care, all long-term health care, all dental care, all mental health care, if we're going to cover all of this with no copays, no deductibles, no premiums, we have to institute this in a way where people in the private health insurance sector will not be left without employment. And that includes the bloated staffs of many healthcare providers who have to process all of this proliferation of competing healthcare for-profit insurance plans. Well, what provides guaranteed jobs to everyone in the private insurance sector is a federal job guarantee. And I think we need to recognize that that is a key element in making a transition to a single-payer healthcare system that can cut our healthcare costs in half, provide healthcare for everyone, maintain all of the decentralized healthcare providers that there are, allow for all the competing enterprises in drug manufacturing and medical supplies and medical equipment and so forth. I mean, all of that is left in place. We don't have to worry about lack of accountability in a single national healthcare bureaucracy. Instead, we can, in a sense, take advantage of both local accountability of local healthcare providers, and on the one hand, have a national system for providing health insurance that will be able to negotiate in strength. Now, by the way, when you talk about costs, first of all, we should be realizing that we are reducing costs in half. We should be able to cut $1.7 trillion out of our healthcare expenditures. And we need to recognize the advantage of what we're doing, because we're now separating health insurance from employment. Employers no longer will have to bear any cost in pitching in to provide healthcare. And that is one of the major drags on our international competitiveness, is the fact that in many cases, companies find themselves stuck with having to pay into very expensive healthcare premiums. Well, we free companies of this, we free individuals of the worry of losing their healthcare coverage if they lose a job. And how do we fund it? Well, we should fund it through very progressive national taxation. It should not come out of payroll taxes, where employees are contributing a lion's share together with contributions from employers. It should instead come from a very progressive, highly graduated wealth and income tax, which can put the entire burden of our healthcare expenditures on those who can most easily afford to pay it. And I'm talking about the 1% in particular, and then extended down to the 10%. And before the great global catastrophe hit us, right, of this worldwide depression that came in due to the mismanagement of the pandemic. Well, we had the greatest national wealth in human history of any single nation. It was approaching $100 trillion. Our national income was approaching $20 trillion a year. Healthcare costs, total healthcare costs, which currently are $3.5 trillion, could be reduced to $1.7 trillion. $1.7 trillion is a 1.7% tax on our national wealth. The top 1% has almost 40% of our national wealth, almost double what the bottom 90% has. They could easily foot the bill for all of our national healthcare expenditures with a relatively small wealth tax. And I think the facts are such, the fact being, you know, the incredible inequality in wealth in our nation that allows all of these programs to be easily supported if we choose to use taxation as a way of funding them.
Mm-hmm. And there also seems to be, that leads nicely into the next question, is exactly how is COVID relating to the necessity for a healthcare system as such, a national healthcare system? Obviously, the people who are affected the most from this are those who aren't able to afford to get tested because they have to work. They have to have, they can't miss work. And in fact, they'd be incentivized to hide it if they actually get it. But at the same time, that ties kind of things that we talked about in the previous episodes together, wherein like you must allow some sort of paid medical leave and as such that these different ideas seem to be working together and are paramount for general health care is not simply just providing this national health care service, for example, but also giving people the time to enjoy a healthy lifestyle as well.
Think of where we would have been if we already had Medicare for all with no copays, surely, no deductibles. Everyone would have been able to go to a doctor to check and see whether they have come down with COVID. No one would be without health insurance because they have lost their job or been furloughed. And remember, we are now suffering unemployment rates that are beyond those of the Great Depression. And for many Americans, that means they have no health care coverage. They can't afford to get themselves checked out. They can't afford to get whatever medicines they may need. Now, supposedly, testing is for COVID is supposed to be free, but it's not working out that way. Many places are charging, and not everyone can go. And of course, people can't get off from work to get tested. We don't have paid leave, paid medical leave. And when the vaccine comes, obviously it should be available to everyone world over, worldwide, without cost. Mm-hmm. Well, Medicare for All will cover that. And it would put us in the strongest position to be able to really deal with this or any other health emergency. And keep in mind that there is both a racial and gender health care gap.
Absolutely.
Because as we've seen, there is a wealth and income gap that is both racial and gender specific. And insofar as medical care in our country still depends upon how much money you have. That means that there is a medical disadvantage that could be considered to be a systemic racial and systemic sexist healthcare disadvantage that would be eliminated with Medicare for All.
Right. And it's certainly very helpful to see how this concept of healthcare ties into the other concepts that we've talked about in our previous podcasts. In fact, healthcare often is put forward as a touchstone for most of these other situations, these injustices, because first you need a certain healthy body, a healthy biosphere, as you said, to actually actualize more economic freedoms and so forth. But one common concern, and it often comes up in the healthcare debate between most of these things, is that problem of government intervention. And to what degree does this government ensurement of rights actually maybe infringe on some of the people who are trying to enjoy their freedom from the government? I mean, the more simple, basic point is people don't like dealing with the government, or they're skeptical of the government in general. So how do you deal with that problem specifically in the context of healthcare? And what ways do we see them juxtaposed to the current system?
You know, one of the objections that is made to Medicare for All is it supposedly it restricts your freedom.
Of choice.
Well, I think your freedom of choice in various ways in terms of what medical practitioner you're going to see. Well, we all know that private insurance plans restrict our freedom in two ways. First of all, if you can't afford to use your medical insurance or to buy medical insurance, you can't see anyone, right? Or if you want to speak in terms of waiting, you wait forever. You wait until you die, and you still don't see anyone to take care of you. But with Medicare for All, you can go to any practitioner whatsoever. And we have to ensure that the medical practitioners are going to accept Medicare for All. I know that an example of, that I am personally familiar with is my mother came down after my father died, moved down to Athens. And at a certain point, she was seeing a gynecologist, and her gynecologist in Athens retired. The other members of that practice refused to see her because she was on Medicare. And I know that's a prevalent problem that people face if they're on Medicare or Medicaid. Doctors are unwilling to see them because the reimbursements have been lower than from other kinds of medical plans. But we have to ensure that that doesn't happen with Medicare for All. It has to be something that will provide reasonable reimbursements, and it will be something that all medical practitioners are required to honor and accept.
This actually brings up another question that I'd been thinking about. When it comes to medical malpractice suits, I mean, particularly with gynecology, they have one of the highest bills to foot with malpractice insurance. And I mean, neurology is another example of something like this. How would that function in a system that you would propose, like a national health service of some sort? Because it surely seems like there would still have to be a industry that's robust around those malpractice suits. Would it simply function the same as is? I know a lot of people who are against these ideas mention malpractice as one of the big objections.
Yeah. I mean, it's to some degree, you know, how one handles private suits with regard to medical malpractice is a question that's independent of which of these healthcare options we're going to opt for, whether we go for single payer or a national health service or have regulated nonprofit health insurance programs. New Zealand chose to basically get rid of a lot of private litigation concerning injuries and medical malpractice and so forth by just providing a kind of a public insurance that covers all such things and avoids the need to engage in private litigation. And that, in a way, will work so that the victims are going to be compensated for their losses in a reasonable way. You know, one of the liabilities of relying upon private suits is that not only does it involve all sorts of expenses, but there's always the possibility that the person or persons you're suing may not be able to pay the compensation you deserve. They may go bankrupt. Right. Well, this public system of a kind of total accident and injury insurance scheme that New Zealand opted for covers everyone and sort of avoids all the time and energy that goes into private litigation.
And that's
now, of course, legal care for all would provide civil representation in cases that involve medical malpractice.
Yeah, and
it would that's another way of dealing with it. Obviously, one wants to keep litigation within reasonable bounds and not make it something that is going to drive up costs in a way that is detrimental to the healthcare of all. On the other hand, you want to make sure that medical practitioners are accountable for malpractice.
Surely, yeah.
And there are various ways in which that can be done.
Right. Again, thank you very much for the talk today, and I look forward to expanding on. And obviously, there seems to be a through line that we hopefully can draw on this social bill of rights continuously, and healthcare seems to be a keystone for a lot of it as well. So thank you very much, and we'll talk next week.
Yeah, and let's hope that, you know, the huge crisis we're in is the perfect storm that is going to bring us solutions. And one obvious solution is to introduce Medicare for all as soon as possible.